Hi, this is Dr. Michelle Woolhouse. Join us on FX Medicine next week, where we'll be talking to Dr. Arun Dia for a deeper dive into upper gastrointestinal health. Subscribe to us on your favourite podcast app and follow us on social media to make sure you never miss an episode.
And welcome to FX Medicine by Bioceuticals, where we bring you the latest in evidence-based, integrative, functional, and complementary medicine. FX Medicine by Bioceuticals acknowledges the traditional custodians of country throughout Australia where we live and work, and their connections to land, sea, and community. We pay our respect to their elders past and present, and extend that respect to all Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander peoples today. With us today is Dr. Simone Peters, a psychophysiologist specialising in gut-brain therapies for gastrointestinal disorders. She is the founder of the Mind and Gut Clinic in Melbourne and a gastroenterology researcher at Monash University. She's a leading expert in gut-directed hypnotherapy that targets gut issues such as irritable bowel syndrome. Simone founded the Gut-Directed Hypnotherapy Program at the Alfred Hospital in Melbourne, and she is also the head of clinical content at Nerva, a digital therapeutic app that delivers a six-week program of the approach. Today, we're going to discuss Simone's pioneering work in the field of gut-directed hypnotherapy. Welcome to FX Medicine by Bioceuticals, Simone. Thank you so much for being with us today.
Thank you, Emma. It's an absolute pleasure.
Now, to get us started, can you tell us what led you to this field of gut-directed hypnotherapy and how did you become interested in it?
Great question. So if I'm being entirely honest, I was probably the biggest skeptic of them all when it came to using gut-directed hypnotherapy. So it all started about 15 years ago now, actually, when I was doing my PhD with the Department of Gastroenterology at Monash University here in Melbourne. And actually, my PhD was on a topic called non-celiac gluten sensitivity, which is an entity of individuals who believe that they have problems with gluten, but actually don't meet the diagnostic criteria for having celiac disease. And so we were doing lots of research in that space at around that time. And then somewhere along the line, my PhD almost became hijacked by hypnotherapy when my supervisor suggested that we started to look into this space. And I think he came to me and said, you know, what do you think about hypnotherapy, Simone? And if I'm being entirely honest, in all of my psychology training, I'd never been exposed to hypnotherapy. And so I sort of said that I thought it sounded a little bit strange, probably not something that I would be interested in. And he obviously wasn't going to take no for an answer, because he turned up at my desk with a big pile of papers and said, have a read. And so I did have a read, and after doing so, I realised very quickly that actually this might be something that would really help our patient cohort. And so I reluctantly agreed to do what was meant to be a pilot study looking into the efficacy of hypnotherapy in IBS patients, but it turned into a much bigger study. It turned into a randomised control trial where we essentially compared the efficacy of gut-directed hypnotherapy to what's called a low FODMAP diet, which is a diet that's really frequently applied in patients who have irritable bowel syndrome. It was actually developed by our group at Monash University, and it had really good placebo control evidence to support its use. So we did sort of a head-to-head study comparing hypnotherapy to the low FODMAP diet, and we actually found that both were effective in reducing gut symptoms to the same degree. And I think that that was probably a little bit of an aha moment, not only for me, but also for our department, in the context that it's very possible that behavioural therapy may be as effective as what we were using at that time, which was predominantly dietary-based intervention.
It was definitely a pivotal study in this space, I feel.
Oh, entirely, entirely. And I think, you know, prior to even the low FODMAP diet, really the way that patients with irritable bowel syndrome were managed were largely with medication. And so it really opened up this idea that not only can we manage symptoms of irritable bowel syndrome with medication, but we can also manage symptoms with dietary-based intervention and even potentially behavioural-based intervention, which is quite a, you know, a huge shift in the way that we manage a condition over the last 15 years.
Absolutely. And I know from working with patients, the ability to, for them to have as many treatment options on the table as possible is always so great for them.
Entirely. I mean, I think in the context of managing irritable bowel syndrome, we now know that there's three key treatment domains that are available to patients that have a good evidence base. Mm-hmm. One is medication or drug-based therapy. Two are your dietary-based interventions, which, of course, the low FODMAP diet falls into that category. Mm. And the third option are the behavioural therapies. And, of course, gut-directed hypnotherapy falls into that category. Mm. But to be fair, most patients respond best to when they do a bit of a combination of all three.
Yeah.
And so I'm sure we'll talk about that a little bit more in this podcast, but this idea that a multidisciplinary approach is always best for managing symptoms of irritable bowel syndrome.
Absolutely. And in your clinical experience, which gut-related conditions or diseases have been shown to respond well to gut-directed hypnotherapy? You mentioned IBS, irritable bowel syndrome. Any others that have come to light?
Yeah, look, the majority of research in this space has been focused on irritable bowel syndrome. And mm-hmm. so I guess when we're talking about data, usually we're talking about the utilization of gut-directed hypnotherapy in that patient population. So okay. we know that it works really, really well in an IBS patient population. But there's also been some studies that have been done in recent years looking at using gut-directed hypnotherapy for patients who have functional dyspepsia.
Mm.
So functional dyspepsia, for anybody who doesn't know, is just defined by the presence of upper gastrointestinal symptoms that are thought to originate from the stomach or duodenum. And these, similarly to irritable bowel syndrome, are without organic cause. So these are your patients that will tell you that they have early satiety, postprandial fullness, sort of upper GI pain, or we sort of call that epigastric pain, bloating, nausea, mostly these sort of upper GI complaints. But these patients seem to respond really beautifully to gut-directed hypnotherapy as well.
Mm-hmm.
The other area that we've been focusing quite intently on in recent times is the quiescent IBD patient population. So mm-hmm. these are your patients who have an inflammatory bowel disease, so something like Crohn's disease or ulcerative colitis, but their disease is inactive, so they're in clinical remission,
okay.
but they have ongoing gastrointestinal symptoms. And so in this patient population, it's thought that they have sort of an overlap between having an inflammatory bowel disease but also having irritable bowel syndrome, and they respond also really beautifully to gut-directed hypnotherapy.
Fascinating. And those conditions can be a bit tricky to treat, so having something else in our toolkit is just invaluable.
Entirely.
Now, you opened the Mind Gut Clinic in 2016. Tell us about that and how that led to the development of your app, Nerva, in 2019.
Yeah, sure. So I handed in my PhD in December 2015.
Mm-hmm.
And I said to my partner then, right, I need to take some time off. I'm burnt out. And I think in March 2016, I opened the clinic.
Oh.
So I was in big trouble for doing that. But anyway, in 2016, in March of 2016, I opened the clinic. And I guess it's really been a whirlwind, I suppose, ever since. It's been hugely well received by the gastroenterology community and also within naturopaths, GPs, allied health care professionals. So probably 80% of our referrals probably actually come from GPs or gastroenterologists. And when we opened, it was just myself and one other dietitian, and now we've got a really great team of many psychologists, gut-directed hypnotherapists, dietitians. We work really closely with naturopaths, with other allied health professionals, pelvic floor physiotherapists, et cetera. And we largely treat patients who have gastrointestinal conditions. So things like we've mentioned, irritable bowel syndrome, functional dyspepsia, inflammatory bowel disease, bowel cancer, celiac disease, and so on. What we are known for is the fact that we do specialise in gut-directed hypnotherapy. Mm. And because of that, the wait lists to our clinic, especially in those early years, were really extensive. Mm. And so what we wanted to try and do was establish ways that we could offer our services to patients on a larger scale. Mm-hmm. Around that time, I'm still at Monash University at the Alfred, mm-hmm. but at that time, we also wanted to try and offer hypnotherapy within a public sort of healthcare setting. And right. So we lobbied Alfred Health to make hypnotherapy available to patients through their outpatient clinics, mm-hmm. which you can imagine trying to get hypnotherapy approved, you know, in a major tertiary hospital was a very tedious process, but we got there in the end. And look, it's still offered now actually as part of the outpatient clinic at the Alfred, mm-hmm. But the wait list similarly there and in my clinic in those early days were anywhere up to sort of 18 months, to be fair.
Yeah.
Huge wait lists. And so one day I had sort of a bit of a moment where I thought, well, if I deliver this all day, every day per protocol in research settings, why can't we deliver it per protocol in an app? Hmm. And so I was good friends with the gentleman who developed the low FODMAP diet app at Monash. Mm-hmm. And so I stuck my head over my desk and asked him whether he could help me put something together. And so between the two of us, I sort of created all the content and drew horrible pictures on bits of paper and said to him, can you make it look a bit like this? and he did his best.
Yeah.
And that was kind of what was the original gut-directed hypnotherapy app. Mm-hmm. And then obviously over the years, we became much more sophisticated and the app is now known as Nerva. But the app essentially, the premise behind the app was that we would make evidence-based therapy available to people who wouldn't otherwise be able to access it.
Yeah.
And also at a much more cost-effective manner. So obviously going and seeing somebody in private practice can be very expensive. Mm. And so offering the therapy via a digital means that we can offer it at you know, much more affordable prices. So that was why Nerva was born, I suppose.
Yeah, it was really born from such a need. And I love the concept of increasing the accessibility of this therapy to patients and reducing the cost. I mean, I'm thinking immediately of a couple of patients that are regional and, you know, this would be perfect for them because they do not have anyone that they can see locally.
No. And the reality is, even if your patients do have somebody that they can see locally, getting in to see those people can also be really challenging. So, you know, you're actually really lucky if you have access. That's the first hurdle. But then, like I said, getting in and seeing these people is the second hurdle. And then obviously the third consideration is the fact that you can actually afford it. Mm. So, yeah. But, I mean, I guess hypnotherapy, another really important consideration is that, you know, hypnotherapy, whilst considered a little bit outside of the box initially, really is recognised now by really reputable organisations. Mm. And, you know, some examples of that include the American College of Gastroenterology. So they put out guidelines pretty regularly, and in 2021 they included gut-directed hypnotherapy as a recommended treatment for irritable bowel syndrome. Similarly, the British Society of Gastroenterology in their guidelines have endorsed gut-directed hypnotherapy, as well as the European Society of Neurogastroenterology and Motility. Mm. So these are really big hitting organisations, and so to get recognition from them that this is an evidence-based therapeutic for irritable bowel syndrome that works is really a big deal.
Mm, it's huge. It's really big. I mean, can you give us a brief overview of Nerva? So what is the patient experience like? What does treatment actually involve?
So essentially the user would download the app onto their mobile device, mm-hmm. and then once they've downloaded the app, they would be almost walked through a 6-week program. So the research that we do is always delivered over a 6-week time period.
Okay.
And actually we know that 6 weeks is kind of the sweet spot for patient response rates.
Okay.
We also know that if people haven't responded by 6 weeks, that they're actually unlikely to respond beyond that time. Mm. So I think that that's a really good motivating factor for people as well, sort of to know to give it your best shot for 6 weeks. And we know that about 75-80% of people will respond really beautifully by that 6 week time point.
Okay.
But, you know, if you're still struggling 12 weeks or what have you and then you're potentially part of those sort of that group of non-responders. But look, the vast majority of people respond really beautifully, so that you'll sort of go into the program, you walk through the 6 weeks, and during that time you will undergo sessions of hypnotherapy. So you'll get one session of hypnotherapy each day,
okay,
which goes for about 10 to 15 minutes. You're given different readings to do on a daily basis. So these are sort of psychoeducation-based readings. So we talk a little bit about what hypnotherapy is, what irritable bowel syndrome is, how the brain and the gut are linked to one another, and why it is that we think behavioural therapies can help to manage symptoms.
Mm-hmm.
And we also provide other modalities, treatment modalities that have a good evidence base. So things like diaphragmatic breathing, which has been shown to be really good for patients who have sort of bloating and distension as primary symptoms.
Mm-hmm.
And yeah, so it sort of takes you through the 6 weeks and we ask you lots of questions along the way. So mm-hmm. when we were developing Nerva, one of my prerequisites was that we could collect data and that I was, you know, I would live exclusively in the research world if I could. So okay. I'm always pulling data and having a look at the stats. And so we ask our users lots of questions when they start the program in terms of where their symptoms are at, where they're at from a psychological perspective. And then if we're doing any trials or we're looking at any research questions, we usually pop those questions in as well. And then at the end of the program, we ask a whole heap more. There's also a maintenance program. So once people get to the end of that 6 weeks, if they would like to continue with any aspect of the program, so if they really liked the hypnotherapy recordings as an example, they can continue to have access to them for 12 months. So once they download the app, they have full access for that sort of 12-month period.
Mm-hmm. Okay, great. I really love that little clinical pearl in there around the 6 weeks is that sweet spot for a positive response. And then after that time, you know, it's a high likelihood that they are a non-responder, because I think if patients know that going in, it really increases their motivation.
Entirely. And I think, you know, obviously we want to motivate our patients to be compliant, but I think we also don't want to overburden them.
Yeah.
And so, you know, it's this kind of sweet spot between encouraging them to do a program for 6 weeks, but also recognizing that you're right. If they get to that 6 week time period and they haven't really seen any change at all, then firstly, we want to just check that they've actually been doing the program.
Yeah.
But if they have been really compliant, and, you know, in research settings, we defined compliance as 5 listens per week. So we're not looking for, you know, 100% compliance, but we do really want them probably listening 5 times per week. And if they're doing that and they haven't seen any response at all, then, you know, I think that that's a pretty clear indicator that they're unlikely to respond after that point.
Okay. Now, when it comes to IBS, why do you think females are twice as likely to suffer from it than males?
That's a really good question. We do know that women are more likely to develop irritable bowel syndrome, and that's by about a 2-to-1 female predominance.
Mm.
It's probably due to a combination of different factors. Sex hormones in the gut are probably one of those considerations.
Mm.
So we know that estrogen and progesterone impact motility. We also know that they impact what we call visceral hypersensitivity and this sort of immune response. There have also been some studies that have sort of shown differences in gut-brain signaling between men and women,
okay.
and that sort of women appear to have more reactive gut-brain axis. So this idea that there's increased activation in what we call the emotional and pain processing regions, and that probably contributes somewhat. Psychosocial influences are probably also another consideration. So we know that a really large percentage of people who have irritable bowel syndrome will have coexisting psychological concerns. So things like higher rates of anxiety, higher rates of depression.
Mm.
We also know that there's a really high incidence of trauma-related history, especially childhood trauma in our patient population who present with irritable bowel syndrome. And probably anxiety, depression and a history of trauma are more commonly reported in women with irritable bowel syndrome. And it's thought that this might amplify symptom perception. microbiome differences might play a role. You know, again, it's probably only emerging evidence. I don't know that we would feel entirely comfortable with, you know, jumping up and down on that one. Mm-hmm. But also probably just epidemiology. You know, if you think about Western populations, you know, if we think about the numbers, we know that IBS affects more women than men. And like I said to you before, this sort of 2-to-1 female predominance. Mm. But in contrast, if you look at sort of Asian countries or the Middle East, that this sort of sex difference is less pronounced. Mm. Why is that? Is that because of cultural differences, reporting differences? You know, we're not entirely sure. But we do know most definitely that that women are much more likely to experience irritable bowel syndrome than men.
Mm. So what are the key drivers for IBS and what's the actual pathophysiology involved? I mean, it's complex.
Entirely complex and probably different for different patients also. Yeah. You know, I think at this point in time, you know, we group probably a multitude of different patient populations under this one subheading that we currently call irritable bowel syndrome. But I think that, you know, over the years, what we'll actually find is that, you know, there'll be different entities that exist under that one subheading. Mm. But look, regardless, if we think about irritable bowel syndrome and what we understand today, we know that the vast majority of our patients, probably around 70%, have what we call visceral hypersensitivity. So this idea that the nerves in their tummy are much more sensitive than what we want them to be. And obviously that means that their perception around pain can be altered. Mm-hmm. And that they're much more likely to experience pain, and pain being obviously a key feature of irritable bowel syndrome.
Mm-mm.
Altered motility is another consideration. So again, the vast majority, if not all patients with irritable bowel syndrome will have an altered motility in the context that they experience diarrhea, they experience constipation, or they sort of alternate between the two.
Mm-hmm.
Genetic factors probably play a role. We just spoke about the fact that females are more likely than males to experience symptoms for a multitude of different reasons.
Yeah.
Probably, you know, this idea around issues that correlate with the microbiome. So we know that people who experience sort of GI-related infections, so, you know, these are your sort of your post-infectious patients, they go off and they, you know, have a wonderful trip somewhere in the world and they come home with, you know, some very unfortunate symptoms.
Yeah.
And so this sort of alteration to our microbiome, and, you know, I guess we can use it to our advantage too. You know, we think about the use of probiotics, or we even use some antibiotics in the context of manipulating the microbiome to improve symptoms in people with irritable bowel syndrome. But the opposite can also be true in the context that alterations to the microbiome can have an adverse effect.
We see that. We sort of have that never well since that trip where they report it was 20 years ago, but since that point my gut has just not been right.
Yeah, entirely.
Yeah.
And unfortunately there's absolutely nothing that they can do about it at that point in time.
Yeah.
So again, it becomes about managing symptoms.
Exactly. Now, the new and emerging field of psychogastroenterology absolutely fascinates me. It's a specialised field at the intersection of psychology and gastroenterology, and it really focuses on how psychological factors like stress, anxiety, and mood affect the gut and vice versa. And this field really recognizes that gut-brain axis, that incredible bidirectional communication between that central nervous system and the gastrointestinal tract that you mentioned before. And I've got to say, as a naturopath, it is so exciting to see this gut-brain connection that we've always known about become so highly specialized. Are there any key insights in this field so far that have struck you or have kind of landed for you?
I am equally as excited as you are, I think, about this new field, really, and this specialized field. And like you say, with this sort of intersection between psychology and gastroenterology, I think the first thing is to acknowledge the growth of the field, which is hugely, it's a massive achievement, really. And also recognition that there is an intersection between how we feel from a psychological perspective and how we feel from a physical perspective, and what we can do to better manage the intersection of how the gut and the brain communicate with one another. I think some insights in this space that, you know, while, you know, we have terms like psychogastroenterology, which are amazing, you know, I think we as a medical professionals could be doing better, you know, like I think the reality is I think that we could probably be exploring the link between psychology and gastroenterology more than what we are.
Yeah.
And we do know that psychological state plays a tremendous role in physical health. But what's also fascinating is that we know that our patients who don't present with any psychological comorbidities also respond beautifully to behavioural-based intervention. Mm. So, you know, like if we think about some of the trials that we've done, we've actually excluded patients with psychological comorbidities in those trials, mm-hmm. and those are the patients that have seen 75% improvement in their symptoms. So while we want to recognise that, yes, people who do have issues in relation to stress management, they might experience anxiety, they might have other mood-related disorders, they might have a trauma-related history, that, yes, behavioural-based interventions can be very useful for those patients, mm-hmm. no doubt. But I think that, you know, we don't want to underestimate the field of psychogastroenterology in patients who don't have any psychological comorbidities, and that behavioural-based intervention for these patients can be equally as effective.
Mm, I think that's a really good point, because we don't want to segment people into thinking, well, this therapy wouldn't be beneficial for you because you don't have any of these conditions. It seems like across the board, the research is showing that it's beneficial.
That's exactly right.
Now, talking about the research, I didn't realise before researching this episode that there's been over 40 years of research into gut-directed hypnotherapy. And I read a lot of the very early studies, and I was just blown away by them and how long the research has been going on. I think as a clinician, I didn't realise there was so much evidence behind it. And you've really contributed to that body of work. I read a recent systematic review and meta-analysis published this year, which was a great overview. We will pop that in the show notes for people to read more about it. But can you just talk us through, you know, it's the perspective on the current thinking, the latest thinking about gut-directed hypnotherapy?
Sure, yeah. I mean, look, you're right. There's been a huge amount of work that's been done in this space over the years, and it all started really with a gentleman named Professor Peter Warbel, and he is based in Manchester, actually, in the UK. And he was pioneering, really, in the utilisation of gut-directed hypnotherapy in irritable bowel syndrome. And a lot of the original work was sort of more, you know, retrospective pulls and audits, but they have also produced some really lovely RCTs in recent years. And look, the particular study that you're referring to, they pulled 12 studies together. So there was 11 papers in all. And so one of the papers had two sort of studies in the one. So it had over 1,000 patients that had irritable bowel syndrome. And all of these studies, so all 12 studies, found that gut-directed hypnotherapy was superior to the comparator. Now, obviously, the comparator was often different, and that 9 of these were statistically significant. Mm. And so what that means is that, you know, 9 saw statistically significant improvements, but 12 also found that hypnotherapy was superior in the gut-directed hypnotherapy in terms of improving IBS symptoms. Mm-hmm. So, you know, to have a meta-analysis that shows that all studies that were, you know, included had showed a positive outcome when compared to the comparator is almost unheard of, to be fair.
Yeah.
And so what we take from that is that we know that gut-directed hypnotherapy improves global symptoms in IBS. We know that, you know, these days what we need in order to meet not only a significant improvement, but also what something that's clinically meaningful is a reduction in abdominal pain.
Mm-hmm.
So that's kind of the key symptom that we measure, but also we obviously want to see improvements in bowel symptoms as well. And again, what we found in this meta-analysis was that the gut-directed hypnotherapy improved pain symptoms. So this is really important. And like I mentioned to you, you know, really the fact that, again, all of these trials point in one direction, and that is that hypnotherapy works really effectively, has meant that it has been recognised by these reputable gastroenterology organisations that I meant to mention before. So the American College of Gastro, British Society of Gastro, European Society of Neurogastroenterology and Motility, even in Australia, so the Gastroenterology Society of Australia, or what we call GESA here in Australia, although they don't have specific guidelines, they also recognise the importance of behavioural-based interventions for what we call disorders of gut-brain interaction, and that obviously includes irritable bowel syndrome. So I think that the jury is out that that gut-directed hypnotherapy is an effective way of managing DGBI, including IBS.
We can be very confident in this recommendation with that amount of research behind it. Now, your research, you released great paper in 2016 and then again more recently one in 2023 and 2024. Can you talk us through the key insights from those?
Yeah, sure. So the 2016 paper was the original paper that we did comparing the efficacy of gut-directed hypnotherapy to a low FODMAP diet. Hmm. So patients in that study received either hypnotherapy on its own, dietary-based intervention on its own, or a combination of both.
Okay.
We had 74 participants in this particular trial, which was an adequately powered study. And what we found in this study was that everybody improved. So at that time, the FDA guidelines were not established in the context of what we kind of use as a marker for improvement. So back in those days, we used what we call a visual analog scale, and we deemed that a greater than or equal to improvement in what 20 millimetres on a visual analog scale is what we would consider to be clinically relevant.
Okay.
It's always great to have a statistically significant, you know, difference, but I mean, it doesn't really tell us that much in terms of what it means clinically. Mm. So anyway, what we found was that people responded greater than or equal to on this sort of 20 millimetre, you know, visual analog scale in 72% of those people who received the hypnotherapy, 71% the diet, and 72% the combination group, which means that all of them responded beautifully.
Mm.
The improvements were also maintained at 6 months post-treatment. So I guess another consideration is often that, you know, the placebo response in any IBS study is huge, really high.
Yeah.
So probably, you know, in any IBS study, you would account for somewhere between 30 and 40% placebo response.
Okay.
So you need to account for that in the numbers of people that you recruit for your trials. And so, you know, we're always very mindful that any improvements that we see are true, meaningful improvements and not simply a placebo response.
Mm-hmm.
So it's always important to do a long-term follow-up. And we know that probably between sort of 6 and 8 weeks, that placebo response, if a patient were to have one, would start to wear off.
Okay.
So in this study, we looked at improvements and whether they were maintained 6 months post-treatment. And we noticed that, in fact, all of those people who responded initially, the vast majority of those had maintained those improvements at 6 months, which reassures us that it's a meaningful change.
Yeah.
And that the response isn't simply a placebo.
Mm.
So what that meant was that, you know, a couple of things really. Hypnotherapy was effective. That was the first tick. The second was actually that it was just as effective as a low FODMAP diet, which meant that we didn't necessarily need to manipulate our patients' diets in order for them to see improvements in their symptoms.
Mm.
We know that actually about 25% of people don't respond to a low FODMAP diet.
Yeah.
And so that also meant that there was potentially another option for these patients. We also know that disordered eating and eating disorders are really common in patients who have irritable bowel syndrome.
Yeah.
And so what it also meant was that there was an option that was available for that patient cohort. We very, very seldom put our disordered eating or eating disorder patients on any form of dietary-based intervention.
Yeah.
And so having something like hypnotherapy available was also a really nice takeaway from that particular study.
Mm.
The 2023 paper was actually a retrospective pull of data from the Nerva app.
Okay.
So the original 2016 study was a face-to-face trial. So that was the trial that I did sort of 300 hours or something ridiculous of hypnotherapy on. I was annoying everyone in the department no end. By the time we got to the 2023 paper, we'd moved to digital therapeutics. So, you know, everyone in the team was happy that I wasn't annoying them. And so that was the first retrospective pool that we published with 190 users that had gone through the Nerva app. And we saw the vast majority of those, 64%, had seen a reduction in abdominal pain, which was, you know, hugely reassuring for us in the context that, you know, the fact that we had taken the protocol of something that was delivered in person to that was delivered via a digital therapeutic was really reassuring, and that results were really similar. So, you know, we saw 72% reduction in symptoms in hypnotherapy in the face-to-face trial and 64% reduction in symptoms in the app-delivered trial. And so, you know, that's a really almost insignificant difference when you think about percentage of response. So we were really happy with that. But obviously a retrospective pool doesn't come with a lot of currency in the medical world. And so, you know, there was then a big push for us to do an RCT. And so that was what the 2024 paper was. So my PhD student, Ellie Anderson, headed up that trial. She did a wonderful job. And in this trial, we randomized 240 patients to receive either gut-directed hypnotherapy or what we called the control. And the control was just the psychoeducation without the hypnotherapy component.
Okay.
And it was obviously the Nerva app. And what we found was that at program completion, 81% of the people who had the gut-directed hypnotherapy had responded compared to 63% of those who were in the psychoeducation group.
It's fascinating to me how the numbers are really correlating. The evidence is there. It's so impactful for me as a clinician.
Definitely. I think the other really nice thing was that 63% of those people in the active control group also improved. And I think that there's a takeaway in that, in the context that psychoeducation in this patient population is really important.
Yeah.
Don't underestimate the importance of educating your patients around irritable bowel syndrome. And we did also have a couple of CBT-based strategies that were included in that, and diaphragmatic breathing. So that also means that probably, you know, on reflection, you know, we can say that actually it probably, you know, it was sort of more of a negative thing associated with the trial, and we probably in future years would ensure that our control was a little bit, you know, more of a control, and we didn't have a couple of CBT strategies and we didn't have diaphragmatic breathing in there. But in saying that, it does also mean that, you know, if you've got the ability to educate your patient and you can do something as simple as teaching them diaphragmatic breathing strategies, they're probably very likely to respond, even if it is just in the context of abdominal bloating and distension.
Yeah, that alone is such a great clinical pearl. And we are perfectly placed, you know, the clinicians and everyone that listens to this podcast, if we focus on that education piece and diaphragmatic breathing, we're really making a big difference. So that,
definitely,
that alone,
definitely,
yeah, is brilliant. But Simone, who makes a good candidate for gut-directed hypnotherapy? Who is most likely to respond? And then are there patient subgroups that are likely to not respond? Like, how can we pick this? Any insights here?
Look, so we have looked into this. We sort of call this predictors of response, you know, in the scientific world. And we've looked at lots of different things. We've looked at age, we've looked at gender, we've looked at IBS subtype, we've looked at duration of symptoms, I've looked at hypnotizability, and really nothing's come out in the wash. We haven't really been able to effectively establish who is more likely or less likely to respond, which is, you know, both a good potentially and a bad thing. Look, there are some people that we don't recommend hypnotherapy for.
Okay.
And those are typically the people who are not motivated. You know, they're not actually going to be motivated to do the hypnotherapy, as an example. But that's the same with any management strategy. You know, there's no point sending your patient to a dietitian if they're not prepared to change their diet.
Yeah.
There's no point sending somebody to see a hypnotherapist if they're not prepared to do the hypnotherapy. So you do need a motivated individual. You also want somebody who's probably you know, not at risk of psychosis. So people who are not likely to dissociate. So we don't want somebody who, for example, has schizophrenia. We also don't, I mean, that, like I mentioned to you before, patients with irritable bowel syndrome often have a trauma-based history, and probably somewhere between 30 and 40% of patients will experience some sort of childhood trauma. Now, that's not to say that, you know, those people aren't suitable for hypnotherapy, but what we do say is that we typically would treat people with hypnotherapy to target their physical symptoms, not their psychological symptoms. And so if we're managing unresolved trauma, then they're probably better off seeing a psychologist. However, if it is a resolved trauma and we're targeting physical symptoms, then something like hypnotherapy is very useful.
Yeah, I think that's a good delineation there, that we need to make sure that we've got other practitioners that we can refer to. Thinking about that, I read this fascinating 12-month study on functional gut disorders, and it compared standard gastroenterologist care with a multidisciplinary care model of treatment, and the symptom improvement and quality of life scores, and I'm always interested in quality of life scores. They were better in the multidisciplinary care model. And you mentioned before around the multidisciplinary, the importance of that. And I'm sure our audience is not surprised that this model works better. But in your clinical experience, what synergistic modalities do you see that we should have in our little black books?
Yeah, I think recognition that the fact that we now do recognise that a multidisciplinary approach is best is worthwhile at this point. You know, like if we think 15 years ago when I started in this space, the idea of a multidisciplinary approach was so far on the horizon. You know, these patients were managed largely by their GP, if you can say that they were managed, and or their gastroenterologist. But really over the last 15 years, we have recognised that a multidisciplinary approach is best. And we see that now in the context that in our outpatient clinics, in a hospital setting, they don't just see the gastroenterologist. They see the gastroenterologist and they see the gastroenterology nurse, and they see the psychologist, and they see the hypnotherapist, and they see the dietitian. And so, you know, we do know that multidisciplinary is best. If you think about IBS, usually the people that exist within what we sort of call the team, you know, what we want them to be is supported by a really good team. And in that team, we usually have a GP. We usually would have a gastroenterologist. We would usually have some sort of behavioural-based therapist. So that might be a hypnotherapist, that might be a psychologist, that might be the utilisation of a digital app, like something like Nerva. Often a dietitian, if it's appropriate. So if a patient doesn't have disordered eating, as an example, we would often have a dietitian included. We know that pelvic floor dysfunction in IBS patient populations is also very common. And so where appropriate, we might include a pelvic floor physiotherapist. Lots of patients also engage with other allied healthcare professionals, which we encourage entirely. So this is the utilisation of naturopathics or seeing naturopaths. And, you know, I think together, if we work as a team, we tend to find that patients have the best outcomes.
Yeah, I love that approach. I really do. I feel as a naturopath, I often feel that I triage patients to the right people and that my role is to really send them to the best person in that space because they will often come to us and they have this plethora of, because we spend so much time with patients, this plethora of problems that come, and it's like, right, you need to see this person for this. And so I feel that multidisciplinary approach is absolutely the best way. And patients love it when you refer them to somebody that is appropriate for them. They're so appreciative.
But I think also on us as the healthcare provider, we need to be really good at communicating with the people that are in that patient's team. And I think that that's often overlooked. You know, if we, for example, you know, in our clinic, if we have a patient that sees more than one practitioner, then that patient is discussed as part of that multidisciplinary team. And so, you know, again, making sure that open lines of communication exist between the naturopath and the GP and the psychologist and the dietitian, so that everybody is managed the patient for the best you know, in the with the same approach and for the best outcome of that patient. I think that that's also really important. And I think also patients love that. You know, when I say to the patient, look, I'm going to send a letter to your GP and your naturopath and your dietitian just to let them know what we're doing together, you know, I think that the patient really responds well to that too.
Yeah, I would say the same. Now, just to finish off, my last question was if you had any areas of research that you would like to see completed or maybe any out-of-the-box thinking that you can share with us in relation to the future of gut-directed hypnotherapy. Where do you see it in 5, 10 years' time?
Okay. So the areas of research that we're currently exploring are, I mentioned briefly before, the quiescent IBD patient population. So these are the patients who have ongoing gut symptoms, but they're in clinical remission.
Yeah.
This is a group that we're really interested in and we're spending quite a bit of research time on. So Ellie Anderson, the PhD student I mentioned who did the RCT with hypnotherapy and the control, is about to undertake another RCT looking at this patient population.
Okay.
Another area we're really interested in, and again, I mentioned this, was your functional dyspeptic patient population.
Yeah.
They've been overlooked for a really long time. And, you know, you could actually argue that there's a higher prevalence of functional dyspepsia than there is IBS. So this is another area that needs attention. I think we will start, especially in digital-based therapeutics, I think we're going to start to see greater integration of AI and what that means in terms of streamlining processes. And I know, well, definitely at Nerva, I know that when the team first mentioned to me that we were looking at AI, I was very against it, if I'm being honest.
Yeah.
And then they sent me, I think often I'm not very good with change, you see, if I can give you an insight into my personality.
Yeah.
And the team also clearly know that because they sent me an audio link and I opened it and it was me talking. And anyway, I was saying all of this stuff. And as I was listening to it, I thought, I don't remember saying that. That's not something that I would say, you know, like just the way that the words came out or whatever, like the order of the words or what have you. It sounded like me, like I was so confused. I thought, when did I say this? I don't remember. Anyway, at the end, I rang one of the guys at Nerva and said, when did you record this? I don't remember saying that. And he's like, oh, no, we just did that with AI.
Yeah.
And I thought, gosh, well, that's amazing, isn't it?
Yeah.
Amazing and scary, probably, in the same breath. But look, I actually think that I have listened also to some hypnotherapy recordings that we've done through AI now, and I actually think it's a better user experience, to be honest with you, than the ones that we've done, you know, recording in an old school sort of recording studio. So I think that's an area that's really interesting. So it'll be, I'm looking forward to sitting on the sidelines and seeing what happens over the next 5 or 10 years in the world of AI.
Yeah, I think it's all going to move a lot faster than we think it will, but there's so many benefits to us and our patients with it.
Mm-hmm. I agree.
Well, thank you so much for joining us today, Simone. I've learned a lot. The key points I've taken are the importance of educating patients about IBS and using tools like diaphragmatic breathing, the incredibly vast amount of supporting evidence for gut-directed hypnotherapy, and that responders can usually feel that difference by the 6-week point, and the importance of communication between the healthcare team. We've talked about a lot today, and I really appreciate your time and your research brain being here for us today. Thank you so much, Simone.
You're so very welcome, Emma. Thank you so much for the opportunity, and I hope that all of your listeners take something from today that they didn't otherwise know.
Thank you, everyone, for listening today. Don't forget that you can find all the show notes, transcripts, and other resources from today's episode on the FX Medicine by Bioceuticals website. I'm Emma Sutherland. Thanks for joining us. We'll see you next time. This podcast is intended as healthcare practitioner education only, and it is not a substitute for medical advice, diagnosis, or treatment. Make sure you never miss an FX Medicine episode by subscribing to us on Apple Podcasts and Spotify. You can also follow us on LinkedIn, Facebook, and Instagram.